My name is Lily, and I've had hidradenitis suppurativa, HS, for years. I finally found some relief since taking Cosentyx. Relief means I can show up more.
Cosentyx secukinumab is prescribed for adults with moderate to severe hidradenitis suppurativa, HS. Don't use if you're allergic to Cosentyx. Before starting, get checked for tuberculosis. An increased risk of infections and lowered ability to fight them may occur, like tuberculosis or other serious bacterial, fungal, or viral infections. Some are fatal. Tell your doctor if you have an infection or symptoms like fevers, sweats, chills, muscle aches, or cough, had a vaccine or plan to, or if inflammatory bowel disease symptoms develop or worsen. Serious allergic reactions and severe eczema-like skin reactions may occur. Learn more at 1-844-COSENTYX or Cosentyx.com.
Ask your dermatologist about Cosentyx.
Off the ball, GAA.
Tip ahead of Claire?
I would put tip ahead of Claire.
Is that because you want to go home?
Well, yeah, a little bit.
Join in the obsession. Subscribe now at offtheball.com/join.
Hey there, it's Owen here, and you're welcome back to Diverted, a 10-part original series for Off the Ball. In every episode of this series, we go to a different country in Latin America, and this week, we're going to Uruguay. And we're going to be visiting the home of a survivor of the 1972 Andes plane crash, which inspired the movie Alive. That's coming your way in just a few minutes. Before that, though, we're getting you back to the hitchhiking journey through Patagonia, and your usual heads up that these episodes happen on two separate timelines. So, Uruguay, that's coming up in a few minutes after we bring you up to speed on Patagonia. And you can listen back to the previous three parts of the hitchhiking journey so far by listening to the start of the previous three episodes. There's going to be some bad language in this episode. And when it comes to Uruguay, it's just one of those episodes where the best thing I could do as a producer was to just let an interview play. If you enjoyed it, a 5-star rating would be most welcome. Cheers.
It is the third day of hitchhiking. I am in Ezcal, a beautiful town in the valleys.
It's around 7:30 on a Friday morning.
Leaving a little bit earlier today, see if the early bird catches the lift from the relatively generous Argentinian or something along those lines.
Yesterday, the 164-kilometre journey from El Bolsón took 6 hours, and it was a massive pain in the hole.
So it's still very much the plan to hitchhike all the way down to Ushuaia before the 15th of March. It is now the 3rd of March. They've just added on what is basically a couple of days to this whole project because I'm going on a side mission.
Instead of continuing my path south towards Ushuaia, I'm now going to travel east. Tonight, I want to get to a town called Trelew. The surrounding area is very much the heart of Welsh culture in Patagonia, which is something that fascinates me. The problem is that Trelew is 601 kilometres away, and I really can't afford to not get there today.
Sí, de vacaciones.
I get a lift straight away, but only to the outskirts of town. Guillermo and Adriana are a middle-aged couple who tell me that they are permanently retired and permanently travelling.
Gracias.
Adriana gives me a media luna croissant for my breakfast, and they get me pumped for potentially arriving in Trelew tonight by telling me that it's a dangerous city and I should probably avoid.
No es seguro? Okay.
Trelew es peligroso.
After a very brief spin, they drop me off 10 kilometres later.
Buen viaje.
Y mucho gusto, amigos.
Ahí está. No, por favor.
Muchas gracias.
No, por favor. Que siga muy bien. Muy buen viaje.
Gracias, gracias.
I'm back on Route 40. Yesterday, this route was as empty and as joyless as my soul. Today, I stick the thumb out for the first big truck that passes by, and boom, we have our second lift of the day. No hanging about. This is Jorge. He is one of the many, many Chilean truck drivers that transport fruit 3,000 kilometres from the summer in Santiago to the eternal cold of Punta Arenas, way down south. The fastest passage for these men from Chile comes by driving through Argentina for a few days.
¿Cuántos años manejo el camión?
Yes, sí.
25 años.
Wow.
Jorge loves his job and has been driving trucks for 25 years. He seems a little bit surprised when I tell him that I do not have a tent.
¿Y tiene de carpa?
Sí. No, no.
No.
No, no tengo.
Sí, porque son 500 kilómetros.
Sí, sí, yeah.
85 kilometers later, we're in a little place called Teca. This is basically just a petrol station and a T-junction. Well, the T-junction that will finally allow me to say goodbye to my nemesis, Route 40, for now.
Sí, para izquierdo, sí.
Sí, muchas gracias.
Cuidado con la puerta.
I say my goodbyes to Jorge.
Hasta luego.
A great man.
Fucking legend.
Say hello to Route 25. Possibly even grimmer than Route 40. But there's no time to soak in the barrenness of the universe here, because today, it seems, is my lucky day. Two cars pass by, and the third is driven by a man named Walter.
Sí, sí, los Pumas. Argentina, los Pumas.
Walter loves rugby, and it's our common ground. He's got me talking here about the 2015 Rugby World Cup.
Argentina y Irlanda en el Mundial.
And he's either laughing callously at the heartbreak Argentina inflicted upon Ireland at that World Cup. Or he's just laughing at my flailing attempts to keep conversation going in Spanish. Walter also loves football, and he asks me to guess which team he supports.
Oh, pregunta muy difícil, amigo.
It's either Boca Juniors or River Plate. And I guess wrong.
River.
No!
No, Boca.
He's a Boca fan.
No, disculpe. Disculpe, Walter.
His wife, controversially, is a River fan, he tells me.
Mi mujer de River.
Oh!
Proof that Argentinians are suckers for a bit of danger in their lives. Now, I've been in Argentina for a little while, but it is only at this very moment that I properly get welcomed to the country. And it is a huge moment, because Walter offers me some of his mate.
¿Quieres un mate?
¿Seguro?
Sí.
Sí, sí.
We pass it over and back. I keep the hot water topped up. And finally, I feel like the gates have been opened for me in this country.
¿Primer mate en Argentina?
Sí, primer mate en mi vivo.
Walter claims that there's no caffeine in this, but I'm starting to definitely feel some sort of buzz. Or maybe it's just the euphoria at the idea I might not actually get stranded today, unlike how yesterday almost went. But this leg of the journey does have to end. Walter is going to a tiny little town called Paso de Indios, and no further. It's about a third of the way down Route 25, and it's 11:08 a.m. when he drops me off, after 164 kilometers in his car. There are still 344 kilometers left to go until Trelew, but the day is young.
In a life where you can choose to be anything, choose to be Walter. Walter's a good man. Being less of a lazy prick and getting up out of bed earlier this morning definitely helped. Managed to get those lifts in quick succession and everything has gone smoothly. The problem now is that it's 11:30 a.m. and I'm in the middle of nowhere.
Paso de Indios is basically a crossroads. The gusts of wind have ratcheted up once again.
If you can actually hear this, then the iPhone has achieved a feat of engineering never seen before in human existence. Because this is the windiest place on planet Earth right now, even though I've been told it gets a lot windier the further south I go.
The strange thing about hitchhiking, though, is that you don't even notice it when your luck is about to turn. Now, this is stating the bloody obvious, but it's worth stating all the same. When you're hitchhiking, no one comes along to tell you that no one is coming. So immediately after the fast start of the day, there's this massive adrenaline buzz that I'm experiencing. And then an hour passes, and the ecstasy turns to mere mild contentment. And another hour passes, and this contentment turns to a touch of frustration. and a third hour passes. And the frustration becomes worry.
Yeah, so this is the first time where I started to think that I could be fucked, to be honest. No one's really coming here, and obviously not a single person has stopped.
And another hour. The worry turns into alarm bells blaring. The wind is too strong now. You literally can't make out anything I'm saying. So I'm stuck in the middle of nowhere now, and no one can hear me speak. Making this detour across the country was a terrible idea. Three weeks earlier, Carnival, truly one of the world's greatest ideas. We all know that February is a short and pointless month, so why not just forget about your job? We've got more important things to do, such as drinking on the street, dancing, playing music, and drinking on the street. When I say Carnival, you probably think Brazil. You're probably picturing the Copacabana or the Maracanã, or just nondescript debauchery interrupted by samba. But I am not in Brazil. No, I'm celebrating Carnival in Montevideo, the capital of Uruguay. I guess I've gone for a more grown-up Carnival, a hipster Carnival, if you will. And I didn't get my shit together on time and I was priced out of Brazil Carnival. And there are many differences. For example, Rio Carnival lasts for 5 days. People go absolutely mental and take years off their lives in a very short amount of time. It's a sprint, to say the least. In Uruguay, Carnival goes on for 40 days. But to say that it's a marathon would suggest that people are moving forward with any sort of intent. Here, no one is bothered if they are first or last in this race. And who knows if there even is a race. Lots of people have packed their bags, left town, and gone to beach resorts. And it's only really when the drums start playing on Friday night that you properly notice that something is happening. The Chamadas Parade, or the Parade of the Calls. There are hundreds and hundreds of different groups dancing to the same drum beat. The dance and the music is called the candombe. This was brought to Uruguay with the arrival of slaves from Africa from the 18th century. The candombe and the drumming was a way of communication between slaves who didn't speak the same language, and it was also a way for them to call out to one another in their homes, hence the name of the parade. Basically, these parades are a nod to African resistance, but this is a hugely diverse event today. It's for those with African heritage, those with European heritage, and whatever tourists happened to accidentally be in town. Every group dances down the street behind their respective banner, and it's this explosion of colour in terms of the flags and the bunting and the outfits. The street we're on is called Isla del Flores, in the Palermo district of Montevideo. A couple of blocks south is the famous Rambla, which extends along the River Plate from Playa Ramirez, home to the greatest sunset in the nation, to the Port Market, home to the greatest empanadas possibly in the continent. In the middle of all this is the Old Town, which is a strange place, because for every city around the world that possesses an Old Town, tourists are generally told to stay there, visit there, spend loads of time there. But the Old Town of Montevideo is not where tourists are advised to stay. After dark, there is nothing happening, and we're told that there are nicer neighbourhoods in which to stay. However, in the Old Town, just off Plaza de Constitución, lies one of the oldest buildings in the city. Today, it houses a museum simply called the Andes 1972 Museum.
After 20 years, you analyze a lot. You remember people, heroism, the miracle of the Andes, that's what they called it.
There's a good chance you know a lot about this story already, or even just the broad strokes, or maybe you've vaguely heard of it. In case you know nothing about it, just give me 90 seconds here to paint a very, very, very basic picture so that the rest of this podcast makes a bit of sense. So, in October 1972, members of the Old Christians rugby team from Montevideo were flying to Santiago in Chile for a game. When flying over the Andes from Mendoza in Argentina, a wing of the plane struck an outcropping of rocks. The plane lost its tail section, and the remainder of the plane slid downwards along a glacier for over 700 metres at over 200 miles an hour. The aircraft was like a giant toboggan. There were 45 people on the flight. 33 of them remained alive. But as the days went by, more and more passengers died. Now, some of these deaths occurred as a result of injuries sustained in the crash. Others died as a result of the conditions. This is at an elevation of over 3,500 metres up the Andes in winter. And 8 more died as a result of an avalanche over 2 weeks later. 8 days after the crash, the search for survivors was called off, and this was publicly announced a couple of days later. The survivors were listening into a transistor radio when they heard this news. Alone in the Andes, with no real supplies of any kind, it was up to this group of people to save themselves. One of the most spoken about elements of the whole story is that starvation was avoided by consuming the flesh of their friends that had died on the mountain. When the winter began to give way to spring, two survivors hiked without proper gear for 10 days through the mountains into Chile. Eventually, they found help, and the other 14 survivors were rescued by helicopter. 72 days after the crash, there were 29 dead, and remarkably, 16 survivors. It is one of the most incredible stories of all time, but also one of the most well-told stories of all time, and a story that people want to tell all of the time. But I'm interested in learning more, and so I send an email to the director of this museum. And even he sort of seems not overly keen to say yes to any old interview requests. He emails me back though. Dear Owen, thank you very much for your contact and kind lines showing your interest in our museum. In order to understand your proposal, and in order to support your podcast project, we would appreciate it if you could send us your personal CV, a preview or thematic skeleton about your project, and what specifically you expect from us. As a basis for starting a dialogue, it would be essential that you have read the book Alive by Piers Paul Reid, and seen the film of the same name. Awaiting your feedback, sincerely, Jorg P.A. Thompson. Thankfully, I have read the book and seen the movie, but updating my CV in the middle of Uruguayan Carnival was not something I expected to be doing. But here we are. He responds again. Dear Owen, Monday the 13th, hour 10 o'clock. Sincerely, Jorg.
Hola.
Hola, Jorg.
Yes.
Owen.
Oh.
Mucho gusto.
Welcome.
Thank you very much.
Happy to have you here.
Thank you.
I'm just giving a short introduction.
Of course.
Jorg is showing a couple around the museum. And of course, this couple are from Ireland.
Ah, no way.
Owen, I'm Derek.
Derek, how's it going? Pleased to meet you.
Debbie.
Debbie, how are you getting on? Good.
So, how much time do you have?
As much time as you need, I've got
okay,
to. Yeah, so take your time.
Doing this short introduction, and then I will treat you like a common visitor.
Jorg is a Uruguayan of Danish descent, a straight-talking and blunt man, but a very fair one. His museum is amazing. In a relatively small place, he comprehensively covers pretty much every aspect of a vast and complicated story. Every single inch of this place is put to brilliant use. Now, they say there is no such thing as a stupid question, but I suspect Jorg here might disagree with that sentiment. I'm hoping that Jorg might eventually make an introduction for me to interview a survivor of the crash. All I've got to do is not come across as too much of an idiot when I'm chatting to him. No pressure.
First of all, we are dealing with an event which is very well known in the rest of the world as well as here. It was the survival story of the century in those days. This story is much better known especially in countries like yours, like people who knows what means experiences, similar experiences. We have the Shackleton experience with endurance in your case. Countries with mountains and snow and glaciers appreciate this story of survival much more than our fellow countrymen.
What do you learn from this juncture? Is the story still well remembered? Are people well educated on the topic here, or has 50 years, you know, etched away at the hardness of this memory, particularly here in Uruguay?
It was difficult in those days. It was a shocking news. You grew up with this story, you know, and those days, from one day to the other, we heard about first the existence of survivors, knowing perfectly that statistically talking, there was no chance to have survivors in the crash of the Andes. Actually, I learned this very young, when I was 9 years old, when my godfather and his wife perished in the crash of Lan Chile, close to Santiago de Chile, the capital. I knew that from a crash in the Andes, no alive person can be expected, only two bags, you know.
Just from your own personal perspective and the own tragedy that occurred in your family, how did that influence your perspective on this, and I guess your interest in this and dedicating a huge part of your life to this?
Oh, this again, you have you prepare a very tough questions. It's not easy to answer because it's not one reason. You, for instance, you have 16 great grandparents. Mm-hmm. If I ask you now, tell me the name of three of them.
Sure.
I will put you in an embarrassing situation.
Of course.
You know, so there are many reasons which may be hidden that drove us to make the museum. In my humble opinion now, first of all, we did it because we went through a time where mediocrity, you say this in English this way, mediocrity was, you know, the state of the art here. We faced an administration which did not focus on values or goal settings, and so we thought that this could be a good pedagogical tool and support for younger people who are coming out from critical situations. On the other side, this is something which differences us from other countries, you know. What did you know from Uruguay or about Uruguay before your interest in the story? Almost nothing. Mm. Sometimes every 4 years, countries who are in a football issue, perhaps they heard about us, but Uruguay is pretty unknown. It's difficult if you, like I am, if you sell technology all over the world with and your business cards says Uruguay, you know, so it's difficult to place your country.
What are your memories as a 16-year-old boy when this happens, and I guess the society in which this was such a huge story?
It was a terrible year. It was a terrible year. We faced the terrorists destroyed the country, hijacking, kidnapping, killing, murdering. It was a tough year. The 70s were very tough, the first part, which finally ends up with a military government taking over the administration. But I'm not justifying, but I say that the military government was a consequence of a group of the actions of a group of persons who, having the opportunity to choose their democratic way to impose their beliefs, they opted for the weapons, you know. And so 1972 was a very tough year with you can see it downstairs in the we have the structure there. It's the spirit of 72, where we mention this situation. You can see the cover pages of the books of the British ambassador, of people who were kidnapped and ill-treated, and you know, and due to political reasons, and this pressure created a counter pressure, and so it was terrible. It was a time where not you never knew if you were not being reached by a bullet on the street. You know, it was complicated. We were forced to go different ways to school in order to avoid kidnappings. You know, it was a tough year, and the society was, let's say, split a little bit. It was split, and at the end of the year, this absolutely unexpected news was amazing. Was, you know, something like a light at the end of the tunnel, something finally a positive news, not sure. Only persons being killed by how do you say, riots, etc. We are more focused on how this story can change your life or the life of those who are listening to this conversation, in the sense of the concept should be, if this group of unskilled Uruguayans, which were not prepared to face the situation they faced, and they were exposed to the worst a human being can or could be exposed, if they could get out of this situation, life cannot be so tough for me. Mm. That is a product or the message we try to sell you here. A concept, no?
Sure.
What we try to apply this concept is in those groups, which are facing tough troubles, young people involved in drugs, people who had losses in their lives, could be an entire family, could have been an accident or whatever, you know, as the survivors always say, everybody has his own mountain range in their lives, you know. So this story is it's a relief for those persons who feel that they cannot deal or manage with their lives.
So I didn't completely screw up the job interview. Jörg trusted me to make a few introductions on my behalf, and I get invited out to the Carrasco district of Montevideo. It's leafy, it's suburban, and broke backpackers like me don't usually end up in places like this. I've been welcomed into the home of Antonio Vicentin, known affectionately as Tintin.
Perhaps you need more speaking it more and things like that, no, but it's very good Spanish.
And Tintin mercifully speaks English.
Hola, ¿cómo estás?
My wife, Ion.
Ion. Oh, you mean Owen.
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 Ah.
No, Owen, no.
Owen. Is it Quinio?
No.
Quinio.
How do you spell Owen?
E-O-I-N.
No.
You like Coke or you prefer coffee?
Coke would be amazing. Thank you so much. Nice and cold.
I should say that it is February, and it's 40 degrees Celsius outside. It's been one of the hottest summers on record in Uruguay.
We usually have 30, 31. It was very hot.
Sure.
But the temperatures we got last days are incredible.
The 2023 Six Nations is up and running, and Tintin is paying close attention.
Did you watch much of the rugby last weekend?
Yes, certainly, yeah. Yes. Ireland have a great team.
Very good chance this year.
Yes, I think so. I think so.
I hope so.
Yes.
But every time we go to the World Cup, we lose in a quarter final. Maybe this year will be different, I hope.
Hate to break my own heart, but Ireland would once again lose in a World Cup quarter final.
What makes a leader? It's a tough question, but this we know for sure. True leaders lead by example. They take risks and plunge into life with determination. And for real leaders, there's a symbol of high adrenaline and high achievement, the Range Rover Sport. The Range Rover Sport redefines sporting luxury with a dramatic modern design that meets a distinctive sporting character. And a well-appointed cabin brings a sense of occasion to every drive. The active noise cancellation feature filters out unwanted sound, making the cabin a cocoon-like sanctuary. Optional PM2.5 filtration reduces odors, bacteria, and allergens, while CO2 management enhances the wellness of everyone on board. Plus, you can curate the mood of every journey with configurable cabin lighting and bring a hint of refinement to every drive with optional 22-way adjustable, heated and ventilated electric memory front seats with massage function. Build your Range Rover Sport at rangerover.com/us/sport. That's rangerover.com/us/sport.
Back pain and stiffness mean mornings rough.
Pain made it tough to sleep until I started Cosentyx.
Cosentyx secukinumab is the number one prescribed treatment for adults that targets IL-17A, a molecule that may play a role in inflammation that contributes to ankylosing spondyloarthritis or non-radiographic axial spondyloarthritis, two types of inflammatory arthritis of the spine. Don't use if you're allergic to Cosentyx. Before starting, get checked for tuberculosis. An increased risk of infections and lowered ability to fight them may occur, like tuberculosis or other serious bacterial, fungal, or viral infections. Some are fatal. Tell your doctor if you have an infection or symptoms like fevers, sweats, chills, muscle aches, or cough, had a vaccine or plan to, or if inflammatory bowel disease symptoms develop or worsen. Serious allergic reactions and severe eczema-like skin reactions may occur. Learn more at 1-844-COSENTYX or Cosentyx.com. Ask your doctor about Cosentyx.
I got real relief with Cosentyx.
Antonio Vicentin boarded Uruguayan Air Force Flight 571 on Friday the 13th of October 1972 with 44 other people. He was one of just 16 who would make it home alive. I spend a couple of hours in the company of Antonio. It's probably the longest interview I've ever done in my life. But it's also one of the most remarkable conversations I've ever had in person. What you're about to hear here is an abridged version of a very lengthy conversation. We begin here by chatting about his early days as a rugby player. It was, after all, a team of rugby players for the Old Christians Club who were flying to Chile on that day in 1972. But we also talk here about his days as a student at the Christian Brothers School, a school that would produce most of the players for Old Christians, and a school that was, at the time, run by Christian Brothers from Ireland.
We have passed during 12 years at school, mm-hmm. and the Irish Brothers was always that taught us rugby, taught us religion, and you learn a lot about what Irish is, what Irish people are. I remember they play hurling at school and things like that. So we were very in touch. We were very close to the brothers. Mm-hmm. And once it happens that we were going to play a traditional between the two schools against the British schools, and we have decided that we were going inside the field singing "Give Ireland Back to the Irish." And some brother heard about it, and he was angry with us. He said, "Please, boys, do not sing, please." They asked, because we were decided to do it. Here, it wasn't a war. Here, it was a rivalry. They taught us that it was not correct to do it.
Right.
It was not ethic. This was a rugby game.
Okay.
And it had nothing to be with what was happening in Ireland at that moment.
So you mentioned that they were playing hurling. Did you play any hurling? Or
No.
It was just the brothers?
Only the brothers.
Okay.
Only the brothers, they played. And at first we were amazing with that long stick, how they could hit the ball. Yeah. It's a kind of not losing their national things, no?
Sure. What were the early days of Christian Brothers like? Old Christians. Were you a good team? Were you a successful team? Or what were your memories?
Well, we were, from the beginning, was a successful team because the team was very young, mm-hmm. and they knew that the difference was we were playing with teams they were elder.
Sure.
So we have the advantage that we were more young and the speed was more. So they put into the game speed. Mm-hmm. And we won lots of games running.
Yes.
make them run all around the field. That was the idea.
Was there some attention on rugby when you were growing up? Were people coming to watch your games for Old Christians in some numbers?
Yes, my father, my mother, my brother. It was a very familiar place, the rugby field, you know. It was not very popular. Not many people went to the rugby games. Really, I think that after the accident, 73, 74, lots of people start going to see Old Christians and start going to see what rugby was like. And you could say that I think it developed quite a lot from that point to now, no?
Okay. When you talk about the accident now, we are 51 years this year. I guess we're closer to the 50th anniversary. You've just been marking that just at the end of last year. What's your initial emotion when people ask you about it and when you gather together with your fellow survivors like you did at the end of last year? What's the first thing that you feel?
Well, it's part of my life, what happens, the accident in 72. And rugby for me, it's not only the game, but we are alive thanks to rugby, because at the mountain, lots of what we were taught about rugby, we put it in practice. And that's why I always very grateful for the brothers, for what they taught us. I think that they put coins into us, teaching us different things, and they didn't know if we were going to use those coins. It's like they put it in a, where you save money.
In a piggy bank.
In a piggy bank, that's right. And they didn't knew if we were going to use it. Mm-hmm. But what happens? When we need it, we have that background that was at the mountain. And you could say that the rugby and the accident are very close together, and we are here because of sacrifice, obedience, and teamwork. But was very important for all of us, and especially I was one of the elder ones. I was 19 years old at the moment, and I remember that it was the first day I went to my captain and asked him, that was Marcelo Perez del Castillo, and asked him, when will the rescue come? And he said, wait, I think they will come tomorrow. So next day, they didn't came, and they went again and said, Marcelo, what happens? He said, probably we are in a very difficult place and they're planning how to rescue us. What was he doing? He was trying to live day by day, and I started also living in that system, waiting and hoping. He was giving us hope, and that was very important for us at that moment. And he also started ordering, and the team started working, and everyone started obeying. And it was very important. There you see the humility of the boys. When I give conference about it, people do not understand how someone can order and the team can obey. Mm-hmm. And don't complain. Our main objective was to get out of that mountain. So everyone, rugbyers and not rugbyers, were the ones that try to get off the mountain and make things every day. And I will always remember the main two things was sacrifice and obedience. Those values that nowadays are devalued. I don't know why values disappear from society. No, they have little values, and that's why they ask you, could you tell us, could you give a conference about values, or could you give a conference about teamwork? Who taught us teamwork? The brothers. The brothers didn't taught us teamwork. They taught us rugby, but they put lots of things inside the game. The best game we have to play it was in the mountains, and we played it with the things that we got at that moment.
You mentioned there that you had one objective on the mountain, and that was to get off the mountain.
Yes.
In the first 8 to 10 days of your experience in the mountain, it was unclear if that was going to be your goal. Because within those first 8 to 10 days, there was still a chance, a remote one, but still a chance that somebody was coming to save you. So can you talk me through, because this is a moment in your experience that I'm very interested in, can you talk us through that moment after 10 days when you hear on the radio that the search has been called off, and what do you feel? Because I presume there's a feeling, I'm not sure, maybe of betrayal or the people giving up on you, but also at the same time, a feeling of, okay, now it's clear. Now we know what we have to do.
That's right. At first, we wait for the rescue, and the days start going through until we hear at the radio, at that small little radio, that rescue had been finished and they were not looking more for us. That was a great hit, because until that moment, we hoped that someone will come and rescue us. And when we heard that, we knew that for the world, we died. Nobody was fetching for us. We were on our own at 3,600 meters. You could see that valley, huge valley, on your feet, all covered by snow, and you were there alone. No one was looking for you. And you could, you start going out of the plane, or what was remaining of the plane, and you say, where can I go? What can I do? It was crazy. It was very, I was going to Chile to see what snow was like. Mm-hmm. Temperatures were very low, was windy. It was October. And it was very difficult for us. That was when we heard at the radio that no one was looking for us. It was, we depressed. We couldn't believe it. It was very hard to take that drink. You have died for the rest of the world. And then you started to create what is known as the Snow Society. The team went towards a society, mm-hmm. with their own rules. We start having our rules for lots of things, for food, for sleeping, for cleaning. We got little teams. They make the world, the work every day. Mm-hmm. And we start from them trying to make the plane more comfortable, until something happens and nothing happens. Mm-hmm. So there appeared Nando that says, I'm going.
Nando here is Nando Parado, one of Antonio's teammates and fellow survivors.
I'm going to look for my father, that he is alone, so because his sister and his mother died at the accident. And Roberto says, Nando, I will go with you.
Roberto here is Roberto Canessa, another of Antonio's teammates and fellow survivors.
But not now. It's not time. You will get frozen about a block from here. That's crazy. Wait. And it was a crazy idea at that moment. I remember when they said, that it's, where can you go? You walk around and you get into a hole. It was very difficult to walk, very difficult to do, because the air was very, very thin and you got tired. But that was the crazy idea. And then they started little expeditions. The days were a little bit nice. They were not snowing, or were not very cold, about midday. And they went around Numa Turcati, Daniel Maspons, Gustavo Sarvino, little expeditions to try to see where we were. But it were, the mountains were too high and they couldn't see. We knew that we were in the middle of the Andes. Three of us, Roy Harley, Carlito Páez, and me, say to the group, they say, we want to be expeditionaries. And when I say today and look back 50 years ago, See, we must have been crazy. Why we were offering us to be expeditionaries? Mm. Nobody was giving nothing for us. And why? Because it was our time to do our work. The boys that died show us the road, and as they died, someone have to take their place. And we decided that we have to take their place, so we want to be expeditionaries. And with a crazy answer, the group said, you go to a trial expedition.
Mm.
We were not so strong, we were eating little, we were cold, we have our jerseys, and we went down the mountain about an hour, more or less about an hour, and it was easy because we were going down, and we didn't know, or we didn't realize what was that when you go down, afterwards you have to go up. And when it was time to go up, we say little elevation and say, oh, there, it's a plane. And we work hard, walk. When we arrive, the plane was not there. And then the night was coming, everything was getting, when the sun goes down, it gets very cold. It was going cold. And we say, well, next elevation, the plane's there. And we walk, and it wasn't there. And it happens that Carlitos fall at the snow and say, I want to stay, I don't want to continue, I'm very tired. And Roy happens to be the same. I always said that I told Carlitos, I spoke about his mother and his grandmother, and I told you things that that they weren't taught at the Christian Brothers School, precisely. It was so offensive what they told him that on the book Alive, mm-hmm. he didn't allow them to be written.
Wow.
And then I arrived to the plane, they came back me, and I remember Daniel Fernandez take the bags and say, what happened? They say, it's difficult, but it is possible. And from that moment, I was one of the expeditioners, was the third expeditioner with Nando and Roberto. Carlitos and Roy deceased to be because they were very tired and almost they got killed. And all the team then work to prepare the three expeditioners to make their work, and we make the first expeditions towards the same place that we made the trial expedition, but about half an hour more we found the tail
of the plane had been separated from the rest of it during the crash. As Antonio has just mentioned, a number of expeditions happened before they eventually found it, and finding it provided a brief moment of luxury up in those mountains.
In the tail, there were the batteries, there were the 50% of the luggage at the tail, so we opened the luggage and tried to find things to eat. We find some grappa. It's a kind of a vodka.
Okay, very good.
Some bombones,
oh, yeah.
Pralines, and sugar.
Nice.
So we eat the bombones, the praline, we eat them, and then we pour in a little glass the vodka and sugar, and we mix it, and we drink it, and we get dizzy.
That must have felt pretty good.
Yes, at that moment it was great. It was very, very nice, and also as we find the batteries, we got light. So we read comics at that moment that we were at the tail, and we slept, the three of us, long around. We could do fire inside that place also, so we were very, it was a very comfortable place. I could say it was a kind of a vacation, a big vacation place.
Eventually, the day came where the big expedition needed to happen. Antonio, Roberto Canessa, and Nando Parado were going to hike west, to Chile, to try and find help. It was going to be a multi-day expedition, without anyone really knowing for sure how long they would need to travel. The rest of the Snow Society prepared their equipment while they rested, before setting off.
They came with three backpacks and say, Tintin, this is your backpack, Nando, this is your backpack, Roberto, this is your backpack. Okay, and I put mine, and start walking, and about 30 years later, we were talking about in an asado, in a braai, about what happens, and they say, well, your your bag had almost between 30 and 40 kilos.
Wow.
And I was amazed. I didn't knew. I felt it was very difficult at that moment. It was terrible going up stairs break, and I have to make another one, and it was very difficult. But I never, until today, I do not know what's the bag of Roberto or Nando, what they were carrying.
What they were carrying, yeah.
Yes, because, and he say, well, no curiosity, no. It's my bag.
Yeah.
And it was a bag that I have to climb the mountain with it. So it doesn't matter what they have in their bags. And I would never try to look in their bags of Nando or Roberto,
right.
Because that was your, in life it happens the same. You have your bag, and doesn't matter if the one that's beside you it's very light or it's very heavy, you have yours, and that's what you have to climb the mountain with. And it happens that we were at the first night, it was awful because night was coming. We were kicking snow so to make the steps, and we didn't find a straight place to put the sleeping bag. And we were getting desperated, and then it appeared a little place. We put the bag, we three got in, and I remember that was very, very tired, so I slept quite a lot, and it took us 2 days more to get to the upper part of the mountain.
Yeah. Did you think that expedition was going to be successful? Like, did you fully believe when the three of you are going up that this is going to be the one that finally works out?
No. We believe that we will do our best, but always all the expeditions that we started with, we thought that was the one that would take us off the plane.
Mm-hmm.
But it happens that you get experience. That was a very important thing also. At the first expeditions, we learn about what was when you fail. The expedition failed, you got the things that were correct, mm-hmm. and you gathered them for the next expedition.
Sure, you learn a lot.
And when they say, oh, you were lucky, it was the last expedition, we didn't knew it would be the last expedition, but we got lots of expeditions before that failed. So we failed there, and we have success because we learn, we had experience, so to how to walk in the mountain, how to dress in the mountain, lots of things. Mm-hmm. It wasn't a thing that you could say it was you got luck. Okay. I think it was not luck. It's little experience that were gathered together in the last expedition.
Okay, so remind us what happens then. That you go back on your own to the plane, and Roberto and Nando, they carry on, and they go over the mountain. I there's a couple of things here. Like, first of all, just a reminder of why that was the case. And second of all, it strikes me that would have been the only time across this entire experience that you were truly alone.
Like, while you were all alone up there in the mountain, it was all of you. You were together.
Yes.
Actually being on your own for that amount of time must have been very different and a different challenge.
Yes, I forgot about it. Yes, that's right. When we arrived to the top of the mountain, we slept there. Nando early went to walk around, and I afterwards went to see what Nando was doing, and Roberto came afterwards, and there was all full of mountains. It was awful. And the only thing you could see was the valley, but on the back part, more mountains and more mountains. And we saw also at the end of the valley a black strip that we thought it was a road. He said, "We'll go back." No, we can't go back. We go back and tell them, "Oh, we think that we saw a road on the end of the valley. They kill us."
Mm-hmm.
And they have the right to do it. So we say, no, that's not an option. We wait. And then they say, "Would you let us your bag with the food? I carry all the food." And I say, "Yes." "And will you go back?" "Yes, yes, certainly. I'm very tired. And I will go back." So I left my bag with them. And that morning, I sat on one of the pillows that was with us. The other one, I put it in my feet and started sledging down the mountain.
Wow.
And when it was too speedy, I pressed my feet so I gathered more snow and slow and correct my position. It was a kind of unconscious, no? It was a kind of, I was really enjoying it, what I was doing. I didn't felt that it was alone. And as you said, it was the only one that was alone at that mountain for about 2 hours.
Okay.
But was really alone. We were not, I could say that the experiences were very unconscious.
Sure.
And were very unrespectful to the mountain.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't knew what mountains were.
Yeah.
We didn't knew the risk were really. Perhaps if we had known, we haven't do the things that we did. Sledging down the mountain at 300, 600 meters.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
Yes.
You're Uruguayan, you didn't know what mountains are.
No, yes, that's right. We didn't knew, and even knew snow, we didn't knew about mountains, we didn't knew about cold. We have to learn, but I sledged down, and my fellow companions that were on the plane, they got off the plane and saw the mountain, they saw a black dot that was moving, it was going down. And they say, "What happened with the other two?" So they went to say hello to me, and instead of saying hello, they say, "What happened with the other two?"
Mm.
And they say they continue, and we have to wait because perhaps they have success. And afterwards, we start working in a B plan, going towards the valley. But it was not so hard as people think. We were at 19 years old. At 19 years, we were very unconscious.
Yeah, wow. So how long after that moment when you come back to camp do you realize that you're going to be saved?
Well, we realized when we heard at the radio,
mm-hmm.
that same radio that at the seventh day, 10 days, told us that we were not, no one was looking for us.
Mm-hmm.
Then that radio stayed around with snow, with cold. And when Nando and Roberto continue, we got the radio again.
Yeah.
And amazing. And one day we hear a radio from Montevideo.
Okay.
At that moment, I was studying, I was in university, and about 7 o'clock, I always hear the notice, and I heard the voice say, "Stop." And he said, two Uruguayans have appeared, and we knew there was Nando and Roberto, so we have to wait for rescue. And that was the day 72. Okay. And we wait all day until in the evening we start hearing the helicopters coming. There were three of them. And then at that moment we realized that we were safe.
Mm-hmm. How did that feel?
For me, it feels like we were safe. We were successful. We were lucky. I think it was a great success of human spirit fighting against adversity. It's not a miracle. It's not we were not touched by an angel stick or things like that. I think it happens that there are two different views of this. The expeditioners always said that it was a success of human strength fighting against adversity, and the others said that it was a miracle. The three of us patients were very practical people. We were very, we didn't see it from the spiritual part.
Sure.
It was a human part. And I knew, and I know that we are very strong inside. And it happens nowadays that we don't take our time to see inside, to take time to think about things. We go to someone and ask them, how could I have a solution of my problem? How? You have the solutions. You have the power inside. Human beings have a very strong and have very, but we always prefer not to think, not to do things, and we prefer other ones do the things for us.
Right.
And take our position and say, oh, okay, you must do this, do that. That's easy. The other thing is difficult, and as he always says, you big mountains are climbed with little steps. Do every day little steps, and then when you go back and see, you have walked a long road. No,
It's extraordinary. There are so many different moments from those 72 days. It was. I know you've spoken in the past maybe about how people outside can't really imagine the boredom, the length of the days and how long that time felt. At the same time, a lot of things happened, but like the crash itself, to the avalanche, to your own expeditions. There is a lot of staging posts along it. For you, which was the biggest challenge? Which was the hardest part of those 72 days?
I think when we heard that no one was looking for us.
Sure.
That was very, very hard, because all our hopes were buried at that moment.
Yeah.
And that was very, very difficult to rationalize, to see I'm alone, I'm here. What I'm supposed to do. That's horrible, because you can do nothing at the moment. You have to wait. Mm-hmm. And as you say, nights were at first, in October, were very long.
Yeah.
Because you couldn't get off the plane until it was about 10, 11 o'clock.
Okay.
Because between mountains, the sun hours or the light hours are very, very few.
Sure.
In summer it's longer, so we stayed a lot of time inside. You have to wait, you have to think, you have to live with all the people inside, and it was difficult. You must remember, I'm telling a story, but during all these that I'm telling to you. It was very cold, it was very hard, people was dying. You could die in every moment. It was very heavy, it was very twisted. Mm-hmm. You feel the way you were twisted, that you couldn't cope with it. And in those moments, I remember they asked God the possibility to go back home, say goodbye to my father, my mother, and my brother, and go back to the mountain and die. It was very, very hard.
You asked for that?
Yes, certainly. But it happens the next day, when you open your eyes, you put on your uniform of invincible, of your 19 years, that you could, with everything, you can cope, you can do things incredible, and put your uniform and go to battle again every day. And I always said that in rugbyers, in the dictionary, the word defeated doesn't exist. You always go front, you always fight, you always do your best. And that's what happens. It happens in the mountain, and it happens in life also. You do not stay quiet. You do little steps. You walk, you do things every day to be in better conditions than you were before. And perhaps you were tired. You were not so strong. You were very, very tired. But as they ask you when you are training, one step more, one step more, one step more. And this is the practice of that. In the mountains, it's one step more, one day more, 1 hour more, 1 minute more.
Can I ask, who were you sitting beside on the plane when it went down?
When it crashed? Mm-hmm. At first, I was at the tail mm-hmm. with four companions. I remember Pancho. And I think it was Menendez. And about 10 minutes before the crash, someone came from the cabin and said, "You four go to another place." And from the last seat, I went to the first seat on the right side that was free. So I sat there.
Wow.
It's incredible.
Do you think about that? The coincidence of that?
Yes. Yes. Lots of times you think about coincidence, you think about numbers, you think why it happens to me. And you cannot have an answer for that. Perhaps they say that someone says, you have to tell your story. It's important for people to hear your story about fighting, about not surrendering. I don't know, but life have gone through. Now this year I will be 70 years, and I have a big family. I really enjoy them. I have grandsons and granddaughters. Life, I could say that I'm grateful for life. I'm thankful for life, and thanks for what I was taught at school.
What about when you did return home in December 1972? What do you remember from that time, from those days and weeks that followed?
I remember that they brought from Chile lots of chocolates. That when we arrived to school, it was full of people. Full of people at the airport. Then I remember when I got down the ladder, I saw two buses, and Brother McGuinness was stand up at the border of the door, and was the wife of the president at that moment that went to the airport to say yes, hello. And when I saw the brother, I stepped down and walked through direct to the brother to give him a big hug.
Okay.
Afterwards, they told me the wife of the president was waiting for you. And it happens, then the brother McGuinness at that moment say, give us a big hug, and he says, up, up, Tintin, up, up. It was a kind of, it's okay, life continues, go up. And we went to school, and the school was full of people, full of journalists. We couldn't believe it at that moment. All the gym was full with people, and at the restrooms or the changing rooms, they taught us how will we talk, in what order, and what will happen. And then what we did, we told our story, and it was incredible. Afterwards, well, at that place, I met my father, my mother, and my grandmother, and my brother, mother, and father, and. It was very emotive to see them again. And when I went home, I went to my room that was there, and I remember the smell. It's incredible how we lost our smell at the mountain, and when we came home, everything have a different smell. And I remember that the mountains, and when I went there, I see it's incredible sleeping in my bed, and in my pillow, and I was very skinny at that moment, and I was taking a soup, and it was one row, two rows, three rows, four rows all around, and I was taking my soup. I couldn't believe it was to be in the stadium, and everyone was looking that I was eating.
Yeah. Do you still live with it every day, or is it something that after a while you sort of forget about, and it doesn't actually have a lasting memory? Or can you talk us through that?
Sometimes you forget about it. Other times you remember what happens. But when you're in difficult times or things are getting difficult, you remember the mountain, remember how you get through in the mountain, and you start working to go along. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But life is not easy. Certainly, who says life is easy, it's wrong. Life is difficult, and it's a big parallel between what happens in the mountain and what life is. Life is difficult. Life, it seems to be very nice, but it has downs and ups. And we have to live ups and down in everything. So we have to be hard in the hard moments, and we have to be very happy in the happy moments, because happy moments are not very often.
Yes, absolutely. It's very, very true. Just one last question on the element when you come home from the mountain. Is it true that some of the press had questions, or were coming at you from a negative point of view? Obviously, the story is well told about obviously the necessity to use the people who had passed away for food. Did that become a source of contention when you were off the mountain with regards to some journalists and some members of newspapers?
We always thought on the mountains that we will come to Montevideo by train, then nobody would know what happened at the mountain. We decided that we're going to say the truth that happened at the mountain in Montevideo. So journalists in Chile started with the idea we have to add our fellow companions and things like that. We say yes, but we are going to tell the story at school, at the Christian Brothers. And as we did nothing that was wrong, our conscience was very clear. Mm-hmm. We did what was necessary. We did what the best of us, and the best of us, and the heroes of the story are the boys that didn't came back. Mm-hmm. Thanks to them, we are here nowadays. And we will in our life, we were grateful for them for what they did, because we did a big pacto. Mm-hmm. We said that at the moment before the avalanche, that the ones that were alive have to continue living, eating the bodies of the ones that were dead. And that was a thing that was for all of us, and we knew it, how it works and what the system was. And we were lucky to be alive. And we were not, couldn't say we were proud, but we did what we have to do at the moment. We didn't harm anyone. And it doesn't matter what the opinion is or what they think about it. To take the decision, you must be at 3,600 meters, very cold, not eating during more or less 10 days, 15 days, only water and snow, and it's very difficult. Mm-hmm. It's very difficult to take the decision. It's very difficult to live with it. But
is it difficult to live with that? I mean, like, I think everybody understands the justification, right?
It understands, but it's a kind of sorrow that you have for the mothers of the boys that didn't came. Now there are, I think there are one or two alive, but when you see them, you see that they are seeing in you their son. It's a kind of, you must preserve the sorrow they have, yes, for the son that didn't came back. So it's, you have to manage, you have to work with it.
Before I play you the closing moments of the interview with Antonio, I just want to go back to the museum for a brief moment, because it feels like now is the best time to play you the thoughts of Jörg on this subject, of how the survivors of the Andes had to eat the flesh of their deceased friends.
It was shocking for all in those days, the way how they survived. And you can read it downstairs in the newspapers column we have, that some headlines are pretty tough, you know. God should forgive them, you know. And my humble opinion is, if that God exists, first he should forgive us because we called off the search. This story is teaching us now, 50 years later, not the issues which were the focus of the headlines in those days. It teaches us about behavior, about goal settings in life, about teamwork, etc. Solidarity, sheer solidarity. Facts which unfortunately 50 years ago were covered completely by the booming knew that they practice necrophagy, not cannibalism. No? Cannibalism is different. Mm-hmm. Anthropophagy or necrophagy is the right term to use. In those days, we were surprised by this. And you have to consider that this happened in a very small country, mm-hmm, and everybody knows everyone. So it was very complex, because you perhaps knew a family of those who did not return, so your perspective was different. For those families, their kids died two times. First, the day they heard the plane crashed, and secondly, when they heard the list of those who did return, and their sons or beloved ones were not among these people.
You said earlier in the interview you don't like to use the word miracle or anything like that. It's a tale of endurance, but a lot of people do refer to it as a miracle and a tale of joy. But I guess what we do need to remember when we reflect on this is that it's such a terrible story on the other end of things, and all those mothers who did lose sons and daughters over the course of those 72 days, that that must be a conflict for you as well, that you obviously feel not just lucky, but you feel that you've achieved something incredible by being here today, but at the same time remembering those who were less fortunate.
Yes, that's right. Those that were not fortunate were my fellow companions at school during 12 years, were my companions in rugby training years before. I knew their fathers, I knew their mothers, I knew their sisters, and it was, and that's again life. People are happy, people are sorry. You are not all the happy you should be, because there are people that are their fathers and mothers that lose their sons. So you have to be, you have to, it's a very delicate, it's a very difficult issue for them. And you have to, it's part of life also. They have a very good answer with us. They say they always give they give us support, the fathers and mothers of the boys that didn't come back. Mm-hmm. So that was very important, because it was part of the deal we have between each other.
Yes.
We didn't know at the moment who were going to be alive or who were going to be dead.
Yes.
But the deal was between us, and they understood the deal that we got.
To meet Antonio and to tell his story has been a privilege. Getting to interview a survivor of this crash is a storyteller's dream, because the story itself really never fails to amaze. But to tell the story properly from this vantage point, it would be remiss of me to end the podcast here, because the other side of the story is just as important, but it doesn't get anywhere near the same level of attention. There are no dramatic expeditions through the Andes here, no salacious details of how one combats their hunger in the freezing cold at altitude, and there is no happy ending here. This is the story of the families who lost loved ones in the crash. There is the initial devastation when the plane goes missing. There is the hopelessness when there are survivors, but none of them are their family member or their friend. And there is the complexity of dealing with the situation that saw their deceased bodies used for food.
This is the most beautiful photo.
I've gone to visit a woman called Ana Ines Martinez Lamas. She lives not far from Antonio here in the Carrasco district of Montevideo.
Yeah, school in the Christian Brothers, and here, football. Mm-hmm. He liked to play football.
Her older brother, Julio Martinez Lamas, boarded Uruguayan Air Force Flight 571 on Friday the 13th of October 1972 with 44 other people.
Here, going to in the plane in Mendoza, where they took these photos.
He was one of nine passengers that were confirmed dead by the end of the first night on the mountain. I begin by asking Anna how it feels to be asked in the first place to have this conversation with me.
Very, very nice is the word. Mm. Being two parts, the survivors and the other side of this history, mm-hmm. so great. So important that everybody should know about it and have it in his heart. It's something so big what happened there. The way they could do it alone, because at first they were waiting to be rescued, and afterwards they do it alone. Mm-hmm. Two months after, it's a lot of time. Mm-hmm. 72 days, it's a lot. My brother was not only my brother. My father died a month before I was born, so he became my father. I was 13 years when he died. This I'm going to say in Spanish because to make it more clear. Hay gente que dice que si tú eras de Carrasco y él no te conocía, no eras nadie, porque él conocía todo Carrasco.
There are people who say if you hail from Carrasco and he didn't know you, you were nobody, is what she says. He knew everybody in Carrasco. Can I ask you about your memories then of 1972 and those few months, I guess, of unknowing for a while, a few days of unknowing, and I guess your version of events and what you remember and feel from that time, even though you were obviously very young?
All was quiet. We didn't know what was going to happen. I was terrible. Don't know in what was going to happen. Carrasco was like a velorio. When someone dies,
sí.
The only houses that were with cars in front of the house were some families from the accident. At school, I was going to school. I don't remember that we had classes from October to December. I remember all the time with the radio. In my class, we were four that had a brother in the accident. Four of us, three of them died, and one came back.
Did the search stopping after 10 days, did that kill your belief, or?
No, that after that, when it was what happened, when they came, the others didn't come, and started my life without my brother. I knew it. It wasn't my mother also. Wasn't coming back, and it was not very nice, because here we don't have paparazzi, but that moment we had,
yeah,
with the survivors all the time, Punta del Este, everywhere, all the magazines about them. But it was a little bit heavy. Mm-hmm. Just it was not nice.
Anna's relationship with the survivors, as you can imagine, is not always straightforward.
I love them most, not all of them. I had feel the same, but some of them know that I can't give me a kiss. Mm-hmm. They have to give me a hug, because that goes to the heart.
Yeah. I guess it's such a unique thing when it eventually comes to light that there were some survivors from the plane.
The list was awful. That moment was awful.
Because they read the list out name by name on the radio, right?
My mother was next to the telephone, waiting for the for a call, and suddenly my sister's kids came running to my house, saying, "Los amigos de Julio, my Julio's friends are coming." When my mother's jumped like a to see what happened, knowing that they were coming to say something. She saw their faces, and after the hugs, she started asking, "Marcelo, the captain, some people of the plane died, and so suddenly she cried, she shouted, "Entonces, ¿quién volvió?" Because those that she knew more, they had died, all of them. And my house, I remember that a lot of people were inside my house, friends, family. Some of them knew that my brother died, but they didn't say a word because they saw that my mother and me, we didn't know yet. I talked about it in school.
Sure.
A lot.
Okay.
To the kids also, talking about the accident, I did it. Yes, but not the same way. I talked about the accident. Nowadays, I'm talking about how I felt.
Sure.
More myself.
And how do you feel?
Wonderful. It's very nice. I am part of this. My life was with that accident. Mm-hmm. And it's not a miracle.
Miracle, yeah.
It's not. Is the way they did it, the power they had it to do it, because what you want, you can really do it. Yeah, it's part of you.
Yes, that's what Antonio said when I spoke to him the other day. That it's
Antonio
not. Yes,
great. his wife was in my class.
Okay.
Yes.
He also agreed with you. It's not a miracle. It was endurance and discipline and certain values that they had.
The team worked, and at the same time, I think, see, if it happened to Chile, people from Chile, perhaps they didn't survive because they knew what was the snow, the cold. But they didn't know about it.
Yes, a blissful ignorance to it all.
Of course.
Shortly after the crash, the mothers of those who lost children in the disaster came together, and they created a space where they could come together and talk and share the grief and the experience of this very unique situation. But they also wanted to help the community. As mothers, they had a special interest in helping children, so they started a library here in Carrasco. They made a call for books, and eventually they opened the Our Children Library. Anna's mother was one of the founding members.
Next month, my mother and some mothers, that they didn't knew, all of them, started thinking about what to do. Mm-hmm. And they started thinking about a library. It was very good for the mothers to be together. Mm-hmm. Because they talk about those things that at home they couldn't talk. It was enough for the house. And in August, they opened the library in the Hotel Carrasco that I told you. Before 1 year.
Wow, very quick.
So yeah, for all those people without possibility to study, they gave them, you could study at home, in the library, or take the books home. One, a football player, Forlan, used to go to the library.
No way.
Yeah.
That's former Manchester United striker Diego Forlan that she's referring to here.
To take books, just to study there. He was one of those whom, and the library was full of kids taking books. It was incredible. Nowadays, the library is not the same because now we have internet, Google, we have all. It still works, the library, as always, helping people with poor possibilities. We are taking care of the daughters of the mothers who started, and it's wonderful.
Wow.
Now they have computers, they have kids that go to learn. You should go.
Yes.
Whenever you want, you can go. We can go.
And we do go. Anna drives me across Carrasco, past the house of Roberto Canessa.
Roberto Canessa.
Roberto Canessa aquí?
Sí.
Ah.
And we arrive a couple of minutes later at the library.
Hola.
Buenas tardes.
Buenas. ¿Cómo estás, Jimena? Un gusto.
Mucho gusto.
Encantada.
Hola. I meet a woman called Claudia Perez del Castillo. She has a book in front of her called Del Otro Lado de la Montaña, The Other Side of the Mountain. It's a deeply personal account of Claudia's experience of losing a loved one in the crash. On the cover of the book is a photograph of two women on horseback.
One of these is my mother. I went with a friend to look for them. She was a very courageous woman, you say?
Mm-hmm. Very courageous.
Courageous, yes. My father was dead in 68. 29th of October, no, 29th.
Mm-hmm.
And she, and what?
So your mother and two friends went on horseback up the Andes while the plane was still missing?
Yes. They were looking. One of them was the mother of Carlito Páez.
Okay.
Carlito Páez survived the crash and was rescued.
Long ago, he was very young.
Yeah. It's an unbelievably inspiring thing, though, isn't it? To have that image of your mother. What an incredible, inspiring image that photograph is.
You can't imagine when the list appeared.
It was Marcelo Perez, Claudia's brother, who died on the mountain. He was the captain of the rugby team, and he was killed in an avalanche on day 17 on the mountain. Seven other people also died in this same avalanche. Claudia and Marcelo's mother knew that he was gone before the list was read out, because she had heard that two of the rugby players had hiked all the way to safety, but he was not one of them.
My mother said, si Marcelo no está in the first two names, Marcelo is, if he didn't walk, it's because he's not alive. She was right.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
This has been episode 4 of Diverted, a 10-part original series for Off the Ball, produced by me, Owen Shahan. Just want to say a big thank you to a man called Danny Luddy. He's from Cork, but he's now living happily with his beautiful family in Montevideo. He obviously saw one of my Instagram posts or a story that I was in town, and he dropped me a message and invited me and my travelling friends to his house for an asado and to watch Ireland beat France in the 2023 Six Nations. Honestly, it was one of the most wholesome weekends of my time in South America, one of my favourite weekends in South America, and there was no way of building it into the story in this episode, but I just couldn't not mention it in this podcast. The only thing I love nearly as much as asado are your 5-star ratings, and a follow/subscribe would be just as heartwarming. There's still loads to come in this series, and my handle across social media platforms is Owen Shahan, as all one word, and there is video content across those platforms to accompany this podcast. All that info is in the show notes. In the next episode of Diverted, we will travel to Mexico, where I go behind the scenes on Lucha Libre culture, and I meet the former Mayo hurler, who will take us on a magic mushroom journey up the mountains. Also, part 5 of my Patagonia hitchhiking journey, where I attempt to get saved from my current predicament. Chat to you then. Thanks for listening.